You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everybody. I think I see your silence and only me talking, so I'm going to try it again. It's 2 o'clock. Everybody should have had multiple cups of coffee. Good afternoon, everybody. So good to have you here in the middle of the day. We're really excited also about this conversation for a variety of reasons for which I will actually explain in just a moment. But I'd like to welcome you to a Brookings event. This one is on algorithmic bias. And if some of you have actually looked at the television or read the newspaper, there was something really interesting in the paper yesterday and on the news, which was about a gender bias in an algorithm that was actually being deployed through a commercial product. I was so excited to hear that because I knew we were going to talk about that today, so I didn't plan it. But to a certain extent, we'll actually be able to unpack that. I'm Nicole Turner Lee. I'm a fellow in the Center for Technology Innovation, and I work on issues related to algorithmic bias and the algorithmic economy as part of Brookings' larger artificial intelligence initiative. This is the second event in our artificial intelligence initiative that we're doing here at Brookings, which is really focused on unpacking, I think, three pillars of this bigger question. One is around governance and what should be the governance applied to this new economy. One is around bias, and our team put out a paper, I think, which was pretty important in terms of developing and unpacking what bias is. And the third area is on national security and foreign policy. So we're really excited, again, to do the second in a series of this. And I'd like to put out a shameless plug. If you like what you've been hearing, follow us at Brookings. We have an AI paper series of which we've already launched our governance segment of it, where you'll find a variety of papers, which I think are very valuable when it comes to liability. And the second series that we'll launch shortly will be on bias, of which two authors are actually sitting on the stage today. And so I'm excited to have them here as well. One other housekeeping tip. There's a person who took my call this weekend while she was off from work as we had a person cancel, Mutali Nakundo, who was not able to make it due to an illness in her family. And so in a moment, you will see that Natasha is not Mutali, but nonetheless, she has joined us as well. So I'm happy to have her, and thank you for taking my call to come on through. So let's get started with this conversation. Let me introduce who's up here with me so that you can identify them. To my far left is Carl Rosanek, who I happen to meet. I have a story for everybody that I have to share. At a National Science Foundation lecture, where he actually previewed what his university is doing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, on facial recognition. And he happens to run, which I think is a really interesting facial app lab that's been really looking at these issues for a matter of years. How many years, Carl?
Too many years, but about 2 decades now.
Yeah. So I'm happy to have him actually join us because I thought his research is really valuable, and I know you all will value what he says. Natasha Duarte, who's from the Center for Democracy and Technology. She is no stranger to Brookings. She has participated in a variety of discussions. I'm very proud of the work that she does around employment algorithms and other algorithms that bias and just the surveillance issue overall. And then my friend over here, Solan Barcos, who I have known for a very long time as well. We actually sat on a panel almost 6 or 7 years ago at the Federal Trade Commission when it came to big data before we actually talked about algorithms. And we've been tied at the hip ever since. So please join me in welcoming these three panelists to the Brookings stage. And let's get started. So I want to start for each of you with this conversation on what we just actually heard with regards to the algorithm that was recently deployed by Goldman Sachs. It was for verification of the Apple Card. Notwithstanding the companies that were associated with it, the revelation was that men and women with similarly situated characteristics, income, assets, et cetera, were given different levels of credit. And the top story in the news was that there's gender bias in this algorithm. So I want to start by just sort of unpacking that first and hear from each of you. You know, what do we make of what we just heard about, and why is this important around algorithmic bias? Pretty important, not just, you know, given the events of yesterday, but just generally overall. So, Carl, I'll start with you, and I'll work my way down.
Oh, thank you. Wow. That was an interesting story. And just to jump into this, there are some things that we don't understand at the moment relative to the algorithm. It is a black box, so we don't know all the things that have gone into this particular algorithm, whether it is one of these new sort of machine learning AI sorts of algorithms, or is it a new way of assigning risk and credit. But at the end of the day, the story still holds that given two individuals, a female and a male with similar characteristics, the male was given credit at not just more credit, but substantially more credit. So that is fundamentally a flaw. I tend to think that this is going to turn out to be one of these machine learning algorithms because it tends to pick up on characteristics that may be implied or inferred in some roundabout way. So Goldman Sachs basically said, well, we don't factor in gender, and they're absolutely correct. But we know when we look at a lot of these biased algorithms that they don't factor in a lot of things, but these machine learning techniques, these models are able to sort of discover these facts. And then apply these facts in negative ways. So we really have to sort of unpack this. And it's unfortunate that an organization as large as Goldman Sachs sort of deployed this algorithm without some detailed testing. And they may have tested it, but maybe not tested it for the right sorts of things. So that's one of the things that we have to do when we go forward. We have to reevaluate the way we sort of examine these algorithms to understand whether or not these algorithms are having some negative bias towards any particular group. So I'm going to stop there and let my...
Yeah, let's go. Natasha, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think it's important to be careful because we don't know what happened. We don't know what this system looks like and what might be causing some sort of bias. And I really don't want to speculate, but, you know, it does illustrate how decisions are being made and, you know, regardless of the complexity of the technology used to make the decision, that have really important impacts on people's financial opportunities. And so maybe I'll go down the road of, like, you know, what are some things that we would like to see? I think Carl's absolutely right that, you know, saying that you don't use gender to make credit decisions doesn't really address the ways that algorithms can discriminate, right? There can be features that they rely on that are disproportionately distributed, or perhaps the predictive goal. So, you know, there was also a story these past few weeks about a health algorithm that is predicting people's risk or likelihood of having chronic health problems. And it was what it was actually predicting was their healthcare costs as a proxy for health issues, and cost. You know, predicting cost was not was disparately effective for different populations because if you don't have good access to healthcare, your healthcare costs will be low even if you have serious health problems. And so I think it would be great to see how Apple or Goldman Sachs is testing these models. I think one, when we look at some of the, and there isn't a lot of information out there from companies about how they're testing for disparate impacts. One thing that is a challenge when testing for disparate impacts that I think is potentially relevant here is whether you're testing for a binary accept-reject decision. So, you know, if you test for are women disproportionately not approved for a credit card versus males, you might not find disparities. But then when it comes to credit cards, there's a lot of in-between, right? There's the credit limit and the interest rate. And so that's just one of many challenges that institutions face when it comes to designing effective tests for discrimination in algorithms.
Yeah, we'll come back to those tests as well. And I just want to put it out there for clarification. In the healthcare algorithm Natasha is actually talking about, just so you understand how deep this is, it was kicking out black patients. literally, because even though African Americans had higher rates of chronic disease, because they spend lower in health care costs, they were actually being disqualified. So, you know, again, as we talk about this, it had nothing to do with actually the racial description, the racial feature. It had to do with the cost, without taking into consideration that it would actually exclude a big portion of people who needed that program. So we'll get more into that, but I needed to make sure that was clear to people, because that really shocked me with regards to that result. Solon?
Yeah, I just want to maybe emphasize what my other panelists have already mentioned, which is I think my main impression of the story is that there's just a remarkable lack of transparency in this case, but also probably most credit decisions, and that allows us to really speculate quite wildly about what's going on, which I think is not necessarily the fault of the people who've been subject to these things or who are upset about this particular story, but I think it illustrates just how little we have to go on when we encounter these kinds of examples. And I think maybe without trying to speculate too much myself, I think, you know, this really drives home the need to figure out different ways of communicating some of the reasoning that's involved in these decisions. And so maybe I'll reflect a little bit for a moment on relevant law in this area. So the first thing I was going to mention is that the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which is the law that governs credit decisions, it's a discrimination statute. It's actually interesting historically that it was the result of women campaigning, actually, against credit discrimination, and specifically the fact that they weren't able to access credit without applying with their spouse. So the history of the law is actually quite interesting because I think it had almost the opposite intention of what is happening here, which is that it was designed to allow women specifically to be able to access credit without having to be evaluated on the basis of a relationship to men. Mm. And again, without speculating too much about this case, it seems to me that one of the objections was that the income of the husband was not being sort of factored into the evaluation of the woman. And I would very much like to understand, this is not something I know, but I would very much like to understand if actually this might have been in some sense like a perverse outcome of this rule, which said that despite the fact that they shared income or assets and so on, the person was being evaluated independently. So these details matter. It's interesting to see how it fits into the longer history of the law. The other thing I think that's interesting here is that this law, and so too does the Fair Credit Reporting Act, require that when someone is subject to an adverse decision, that the creditor actually give reasons for that adverse decision. I tend to avoid asking who's experienced this because no one wants to raise their hand to say they have been denied credit. But I actually got one of these things recently, and it's very interesting to kind of see the reasons that you're offered. They tend not to be terribly helpful. But the reason I mention it, we can talk more about that for sure. But the reason I mention it is that, as Natasha pointed out, there's many different parts of the credit decision-making process that are sort of up for, you know, some change. So not just the decision to lend, but at what interest rate and on what terms and the credit limit. And my understanding is that these adverse action notice requirements apply to the decision to lend and to the interest rate, but I don't know if it actually applies to the credit limit, which is an interesting question. So people have responded like, you know, why isn't there an adverse action notice in this case? And I actually, not being a lawyer, am not confident I know that it would actually even apply. And it would be interesting to ask, you know, if it did apply to the credit limit, would we have gone at, would this person have received an explanation that they would have found satisfying?
That's right. And that's interesting too, right? Because, and we're going to unpack this a little bit with regards to the technical pieces, because I think I'm hearing a little bit of that. But then also I want to go to Natasha on this whole idea of this framing, particularly when we look at things like credit reporting, employment, housing. I was just at a conference on fair lending and the use of algorithms there. I would think that it's really hard, to Solon's point, because some of these things have been previously litigated and settled, right? And so now, even though in this particular case, credit limit may not be one of those protected parts of the Credit Reporting Act, but it still, you know, brings up questions for things that are people being denied credit just because of their gender, people being denied housing because of their race. What do we do with all that? How do we unpack all that? Because that seems to be, I think, the problem we're butting up against when it comes to algorithmic discrimination.
Yeah, and I don't know that, that, you know, all of the potential ways that models can be discriminatory, even in the cases of sort of credit and housing where there are clearly anti-discrimination laws, that it really is sort of litigated and settled.
Right.
I mean, it's settled that you can't use someone's race or gender to determine their credit, but there's still a lot of, as we were talking about, you know, other ways that disparate impacts can occur that are not necessarily, you know, in housing, for example, housing and in employment, if there's a disparate impact, so the discrimination is not intentional, but the way that a decision is being made is resulting in discriminatory effects, defendant can defend themselves by saying that there was a, you know, legitimate business need for the method that they were using to make the decision, and it's not clear what that means when we're talking about using statistical analyses to categorize people or to make distinctions between people. So, for example, and Solan can talk about this much better than I can, but when it comes to using statistical analysis to predict who's going to be a better employee, you know, what does it mean for something to be a job-related business necessity under the Fair Housing Act? Is just a statistical correlation enough? And I don't think that it has clearly been litigated and settled. So there's a lot of questions that haven't been settled here. And then there is just the difficulty in identifying and challenging the discrimination in the first place. You know, as in the case of credit, there's a lack of information. You know, people are being screened in with software for job interviews and you know, even for things like tenant screening, and there's some tenant screening products out there that claim to look at people's social media as part of the screening, and you may not know that you were subject to something like that, let alone be able to make a connection between that and a potential discriminatory impact on you sufficient to make out a case, you know, that a court could hear. So it's a really difficult road ahead for litigating these things.
Yeah, we were talking about it in the break room, and I want Solan to actually talk about this, and this is a subject of one of his papers for our series, right? We were talking about we would have probably never known about the impact of this recent credit card if the people who were to apply weren't as wealthy, right? So it just so happened that someone was the co-founder of one of the companies, and these are people who had pretty good assets that can get on TV and say, hey, you know, my wife's credit limit is lower than mine, but so on. You and I both know for most people, the opacity of the internet is not going to have people saying, hey, did you get a denied a loan today on the internet as a result of applying? So what do we do with like disparate impact? And I know you've looked at that in employment. How do we protect people in this new algorithmic economy?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this example from this week is that there was this natural point of comparison this woman had with her husband, which we often tend to lack, right? So when we apply to jobs, it's not like we're often applying with our peers where we can know exactly the information they submitted and the information we submitted and then ask, well, we look pretty similar. Why did one of us get invited for an interview and another person did not? Most of these decisions that are now driven by algorithms are situations where we're often acting as individuals. And the way to establish a disparate impact is to see the aggregate effect of the decision, meaning how it affects everyone, not just me as a person. And so this has always been, I think, one of the weaknesses of discrimination law in general, but it's been made even more, I think, pernicious in the case of algorithms where you don't even really have some intuition that there might be something wrong here, right? So historically, there might have been certain kinds of questions that on their face seemed a bit wrong, or you might have been in an interview, for instance, for a job, and the person asked you what you would see as an inappropriate question or expressed some belief that you would think suggests they have prejudicial beliefs. Those things are really absent. We don't have these signals or cues when you're interacting with a computer. And so this really puts a lot of pressure on trying to, I think, reverse the burden of how we actually even establish that there might be something wrong. This has always been problematic, but it's much more so now that I have a number of colleagues who've been arguing that literally there just needs to be a kind of expectation that the person making the decision, the employer or the creditor, bears the burden of actually performing the analysis themselves to determine if there's some avoidable disparate impact, rather than expecting that people are in a position to even figure this out for themselves.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's interesting. That's some of the things that we're working on at Brookings. You're so right. Like, there's people don't know this is happening to them. And if you go a little deeper, and I'm not a technologist, I'm a sociologist just by trade, right? This whole power ranking of algorithms and what people see and what they don't see also contributes, I think, to this economy where it becomes even more difficult because because your affinity groups really define who you are. And if you stay within those affinity groups, it's like I was talking to a group where people, they were trying to figure out algorithmic bias against 55 and up. Uh-huh. And then they realized that potentially people who are 55 and up probably don't see stuff that people see 54 and under, right? Because of the algorithm. So, Carl, I want to switch now, though, to facial recognition. If you're following us on the webcast, it's AI bias. It's our hashtag. And just a few, I'll go out to questions from the audience. So you can write those down, and we'll be able to ask those. But you're in the space where facial recognition is, I think, one of those other triggers. My colleague here, Daryl Rush, just wrote around facial recognition, what we should do in terms of some guardrails. There's a positive use case, and then there's a negative use case. And I'd like to hear a little bit about how do we actually look at facial recognition in the context of this discriminatory bucket.
Thank you. So just to give you a little bit of a background, I started doing face recognition in the mid-90s for my dissertation, took a little break to work in corporate and came back into academia and start to study this. In the early days, we wanted to dramatically improve face recognition for national security reasons. This was supposed to 9/11. And the technology in and of itself was not very good. So my lab, I worked on understanding some of these sensitivities with the face recognition. In particular, these sensitivities were around things like time gaps. So when you enroll and then when you match. Now we've moved up into these other areas in which we've looked at the performance of face recognition for different age groups. So for young and older, young adults and older adults, face recognition performs really well. Then we get into those mid-ages, and it doesn't perform as well. And we start to look at some of these gender differences as well. So over the last 20-plus years, what we've done is we've started to kind of make inroads into all of these sort of sensitivities around face recognition. A lot of this work is led by the good folks at NIST. Now, with that said, let me step back and say, well, it's a wild, wild west out there, okay? So people see great opportunities to make significant amounts of dollars, so they are not doing the due diligence of understanding the capacity of their algorithms to be biased. And so in our space, in the academic space and working with some of the governments, we have taken a very methodical approach, but maybe we haven't moved fast enough in this approach to start to look at all of these models of sensitivities. For example, NIST has been looking at face recognition for since the 80s, mm-hmm. Since 1986 to be exact, and now they're just turning their attention to looking at these racial biases and discriminations within the space of face recognition. Now, when I say that, we have to be really cautious because it's extremely complex. And what makes it complex is we like to use the term face recognition to encompass all algorithms. These algorithms are today, 99.9% of these algorithms are based on some sort of deep learning. However, what's important is how you teach these algorithms to do face recognition. And so in the teaching process of these algorithms, you may have different biases that you are injecting or not into these algorithms. So what I'm saying is that we use the term face recognition and we say all algorithms are biased. Some algorithms are biased other ways. So we need to take ownership of understanding the capacity of our algorithms to perform the task. And so that gets back to Goldman Sachs and the story here. Who went through the process of doing the deep analysis and evaluation of these algorithms to look at these potential use cases and to understand that this phenomenon, this thing may crop up? There should be somebody in the room who owns that within every company and every government and every institution. Now, we often think that our regulators are responsible, and in some ways they are, but they're behind the curve. They're trying to understand this technology. It's moving so quickly that they are literally saying, how do we evaluate and what questions do we ask? So they're in a position in which, you know, they don't want to stop progress, right? Because some of these things could be life-changing, But at the same time, how do I then measure them? What do I do? So I'm calling on all of the developers, all the companies, and regulators to work together to come up with ways of evaluating these algorithms and understanding these sensitivities before we deploy them widely.
Right. So I'm going to actually ask you two parts questions, and anybody can answer as well. So explain first, because part of, I think, what we've seen in the facial recognition area, particularly from a technical standpoint, is the confusion between facial analysis and facial detection. Right. So I want to start there.
Okay.
Where is the line blurred that we keep seeing sort of this pushback? Well, that's facial analysis, which actually detects, you know, the length of your forehead and the width between your eyes and all this other stuff versus the application of facial detection, because it seems to me where people are getting kind of crazed is on the facial detection side,
right,
versus the facial analysis. So speak to, as a scientist, speak to us.
Yeah, so thank you for that question, and I really do say thank you, because within the sphere and the research community, you know, we hear the word face recognition and people are throwing everything at it, and for us it means something very specific. So face recognition is sort of the identification or matching two faces, you know, with a and then coming up with a score that then assigns the likelihood that these two faces are one and the same. Facial analytics looks at other attributes of the face. It does not make any identity claims whatsoever. It may state something like you are male or female, you may belong to a racial group, you may be of this age. And then there is facial attributes, which then goes on and looks at things like different attributes of the face, like eyebrow type, nose shape, and so forth. So there are four areas in which encompasses this whole thing. Face recognition is the first area, facial analytics, facial attributes, and then affective computing, which looks at emotions and expressions of emotions. So we kind of put this all under the face recognition banner. And it gets a little confusing when we do that, especially with sort of the professional groups that are trying to explain and understand, you know, what the issues are and explain it to the public about these issues. And if we don't have a good, clear definition, it's really hard for us to kind of zero in and focus on some of the problems. So some of this work started a while back with some work that came out of MIT Media Lab that was looking at sort of bias. And the bias was in sort of gender determination from an image. And then it got sort of said, well, face recognition is biased and doesn't work as well on males as it does on females as it does on males. And what's really interesting is that although it was looking at facial analytics, the truth is that these algorithms do have a gender bias. I've studied many, and there's only one algorithm that I've seen that has flipped. And I would love to talk to the engineers of that algorithm to figure out why it's flipped. There are some things that we do know, and there's some things that we are still discovering about this technology that we're using called deep convolutional neural networks. This is in the space of machine learning. And these deep convolutional neural networks have impacted our lives tremendously. It gives us the ability to go out there and talk to our device. It's, you know, our Alexa, these personal assistants. It has moved the envelope on products that we use in the consumer space. At the same time, we don't really understand a lot of how these algorithms are making some of the decisions that it makes. And so we in the research community are you know, trying to understand that more richly so that we can then, you know, fix these algorithms in some regards, or at least be able to better explain why we see these particular phenomenons.
Right.
So a particular phenomenon that I'm seeing, although I say there are many, many different algorithms, a phenomenon that I continue to see is that females, whether it's face recognition, facial analytics, or any of the face things, tend to do poorer than males. I don't understand that truly. I don't know anyone in the academic space that I've talked to who really understands why that's the case. This is something that we fundamentally have to understand. Now, if you're out there building these algorithms, it is incumbent that you understand these things and you make it known to the community that you're going to have this slight difference. And so what does that mean in its use case? I mean, we don't have to run and hide from bias. We need to embrace it and understand it. And then we need to apply that to the use cases to say, hey, is this ready for prime time in this particular use case? If it's not, that's fine. Let's not put it there.
Right, right. Carl, you're bringing up my Energy Star standard.
I'm sorry.
Look, he's like a preacher. He was about to keep going, right, on this one, because you're so right. But I want to keep on this, though, and I want to toss it over to Solon and Natasha.
Absolutely.
Even though women have a poor outcome, we're seeing the same thing with African Americans in terms of skin complexions. I mean, I was at a meeting not too long ago. Some of you have been following me. I have changed my hair. According to the facial recognition or face detection piece, they would not recognize me because the detection models are not good. How does that impact, particularly in the cases of law enforcement and other areas where we're seeing sort of this the use of technology to overcriminalize? To Natasha, so what do we do about that? Because that goes back to, I think, the employment algorithms. If the technology is not great, which is Carl's point, do we stop it? Do we test it? Or do we put guardrails in place to say it should not be applied?
So in the case of face recognition that is used by law enforcement or other government actors, for example, in the national security context, where an identification or a misidentification can impact someone's freedom. There are groups that are supporting, moratoria on moratoriums. Is moratoria the plural? I don't know.
Right. What does the machine learning say, right?
on the use of those tools until appropriate safeguards can be put in place. Because one thing that we are learning in the law enforcement context is it's not just about the accuracy rates of the model in a test setting. The Georgetown Center on Privacy and Technology's most recent reports show that there is a lot of misuse of the tools in on the ground law enforcement settings. So things like having a low quality image and where someone's eyes are closed, for example, and copying and pasting open
right.
eyes
lighting
onto
is
it.
Another one. Yeah,
there is one case where they had a grainy image from a security camera of someone who kind of looked like Woody Harrelson, so they used Woody Harrelson's image as the probe image in the face recognition system. So you could have really great accuracy rates in a test setting, but if the tools are going to be used in that way, it doesn't matter what the test results are. So there has to be not just like good enough accuracy and good enough parity, but also restrictions to make sure that things are being used appropriately given those results. Mm-hmm. So if you know from testing that a tool doesn't work well when you submit a grainy image, there needs to then be a regulation stopping people from submitting a grainy image and then using that to make an identification. But I also want to touch on the face analysis piece because I think outside of the sort of government use cases, when we're talking about commercial uses, mm-hmm. I am a little bit more concerned about some of the uses of face analysis. Mm-hmm. Than a face recognition. Of course, there are concerns with face recognition, and especially with how it performs across different groups. But with face analysis, I think there are concerns about whether it is even doing what people think it's doing. Mm-hmm. So, there's a product that I am aware of that is marketing a face analysis tool for stores, brick-and-mortar stores, to use.
Right.
To determine how to approach customers when they come in. So it advertises that it can predict things like whether someone is a compulsive shopper or what someone's mood is. And there's just not a lot of scientific basis to that. Maybe you can use face analysis to detect whether someone is smiling to, various degrees of accuracy. But that doesn't mean that you can detect whether, what they're actually feeling, what their actual mood is. Similarly, with I've spent more time looking at natural language processing, so analyzing text. You know, it's very popular to analyze in both commercial and government contexts what people are saying on social media. You can a computer can analyze, you know, the words that you're using. Sometimes it can analyze the order of those words and, you know, something about the way that the words are arranged. But that doesn't mean that you can predict from that the actual intent of the speaker, whether they're joking or not, what their mood was when they wrote that. So I think there's a big disconnect when we're talking about especially vendors selling these products to people who are going to interface with consumers and use them, a big disconnect between what is being sold and what the thing can actually do.
Sullivan, want to jump in?
Yeah, so I want to have a, I want to shout out my former colleague Travis Hall, who's here in the audience, because he and I actually went to grad school together, and early on in our PhDs, we worked with the same supervisor and helped contribute to a report that was drafted for DHS, actually. That was about facial recognition, and this report is now more than 10 years old, I think. Is that right? Yeah. And at the time, I learned a huge amount, but I just figured, oh, you know, much of this must be irrelevant at this point. I imagine the field has moved on dramatically because the underlying algorithms have actually completely changed in that period. Yeah. But actually, all the same lessons from that report still apply, and there are many of the same things that Natasha was just bringing up, which is that the reported performance of these systems in these NIST competitions, for instance, are probably a really bad indication of how this is going to work in practice when applied to a particular setting. And what we really want to know is how this is going to work in situ. Like, how will this actually operate under the very specific conditions where it's applied? So is the camera getting a good image of the person? Is the lighting appropriate? And so on. And more than that, how are the operators actually using the system? So are they actually being presented a set of 10 possible candidates and asked to select among those? Are they presented with one candidate? What training do they receive? How do they actually act on these recommendations? All these things are actually deeply important when we're trying to assess how these perform in practice. And much of that is not really included in the standard way that we report these things, because these are tests that are often very difficult to execute, and they don't generalize. Like, it will be about the performance of the system in this particular case, not in all cases. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done to think about careful evaluation in the context of use that is very sensitive to the fact that there's a huge amount of human involvement that will vary considerably from case to case.
Yeah. I mean, this is so interesting, and I'm like, I wish we had, like, more time, because
I need more time.
I know, right? Let me tell you, the last time I talked about algorithmic bias, I was with a lawyer and a engineer, and it took us a year to write the paper, right? Because, yeah, I'll be quiet. Simply because it's so hard to, like, nuance these things. So I have a question. I was on a panel last week, I think it was last week, and I was told that algorithms could actually do the debiasing, right? That we're actually in this place. Well, algorithms in and of itself can actually, you know, filter out a lot of the discrimination that we're talking about. So I've got two popcorn questions to ask, and then I'm going to open up to the audience, because I've got two engineers up here, two scientists up here. Can an algorithm itself actually reduce bias? Are we in this world where the equation or the model could actually get rid of some of these other factors that we've been talking about, which are unknown?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You just set me up, because that's part of some of the research that we're currently doing, within my lab, and I have some really just talented students working on that. So we are literally using another form of AI called evolutionary algorithms to train these big deep learning machines. And what we're trying to do is determine whether or not it is impossible to do that. Early indications are favorable, but we still have a lot more research to do. And I know that this is a popular topic with other research communities out there. There's just not a lot that's been published on that. And we hope to sort of add to the literature on that in that domain. Mm-hmm. We do have to be cautious, because Salon brought up an interesting point, is we are working with inside data sets within our lab, and we're saying, hey, can we reduce algorithm bias? And we're going to use this other AI to train it. And we have these set of data sets that we use and we compare to. And lo and behold, we get good results and we reduce this bias for some reason. And then we go and we try to take this and apply it to another data set or to a use case. And guess what happens? They often break.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so what I get back to is, you know, as researchers, as commercial entities, we have to put a lot more care into doing these evaluations and in particular these use case evaluations. And then, honestly, we got to just apply a simple sniff test. If someone comes up to me and tells me that, you know, I'm going to be able to tell you whether or not this person is going to be buy more because of their face, there's no scientific evidence whatsoever anywhere. And I did some really crazy research, okay, that supports that. So we have to start with some common sense, and we have to look deep into the literature to understand. As far as being able to describe emotions, you know, Natasha's absolutely correct. You may be able to say that they're smiling, but you have no idea what's really behind that. But so let's be cautious there.
And I want to pass it over to Solana. I want you to actually answer this too. But there have been conversations around, well, if we can remove some of the biases by actually taking people's, how they strut, you know, how stiff their back is, and sort of make these biometric determinations of the fact that they're this, which are more likely this. I've actually heard some of that stuff go on too, which then determines, for example, the sniff test, right? I've tried to get people to sniff really well, but it's not working. That's why you're here. But the same thing, can we de-bias from a technical standpoint any of these models? And I want you to pick up on part B. Will we ever have training data that is fully accurate for us to actually de-bias?
Yeah, so you'll maybe not like my very academic answer, but I think it really depends on what we mean by bias. So, you know, a trivial way of trying to solve this problem is to kind of make things as bad for everyone as the group for which that model performs the worst. And in some sense, this means that the thing is performing the same for all groups, but that's not really what we mean when we're saying that we want this thing to be unbiased. If what we mean is that we want it to be as good for everyone as it is for the best group, right? Maybe we can try to figure out ways of doing that. And some of the more obvious things that people have considered are trying to collect more diverse data sets so that these models can actually learn from more examples and therefore perform equally well. But I think there's still kind of an ongoing question about whether even when we have equal representation of different groups in the data set, if that's sufficient to still achieve reasonably similar accuracy rates across groups. And I think it's an interesting, like, scientific question why that doesn't seem to be the case in some cases. But then I think it also comes to this even more basic question, which is, like, what is the task we're trying to solve? Because I think often our objection has less to do with whether or not this performs less well for some group than another than that the actual application this is being put toward is itself suspect, right? So in the case of trying to infer people's intent to purchase, but also I think in some of these criminal justice and national security settings where maybe we actually just object to the use of technology for those purposes at all, and it has actually very little to do with whether or not the model performs well or not for some populations. And to kind of drive this point home, people for the past couple of years have been trying to figure out how to reconcile the position that some people want to advocate for improving these systems where other people want to advocate for banning them. And I think the kind of pithy way of stating the concern is that, you know, when these systems work well, they're Orwellian, and when they work poorly, they're Kafkaesque, right? Yeah. And so in some sense, we're stuck between these two different situations, right, which are both undesirable. And I think it just really depends on what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. So it seems to me, as I listen to you all, this is a mouthful for policymakers to actually understand, right? So from the technical side, I don't know about you all, but I'm following them, right? That this becomes a really hard scenario to actually apply, you know, how you look at bias, because one, you have to define what it is.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a certain level of differentiation that happens, right? There are features that you can do in the lab that can essentially help you to figure out, I like this whole, the best and the poor case. But policymakers, in the end, are interested in the worst case. Right? They are interested in what happened as a result of X,
Are more people being criminalized because of a technology? Are more people not getting jobs or being rejected in loans? Or are we seeing predatory advertising and lending and other things that are happening simply because of the opacity of the internet? So, Natasha, if you were to put policymakers up here and heard this, they wouldn't know what to legislate, right? So I'm really curious, moving forward, and then we'll go to question and answers. So where are the pressure points of where policymakers should sort of be getting into this debate? There's a lot of bills on algorithmic transparency, accountability, improving training data. But at the end, this is a very complicated continuum. So I'm curious to see what you think.
So first I'm going to make really quickly a high-level point, and then I'll actually answer your question in a practical way. Because I want to pick up on what Solon said about, you know, is what we're using this system for really something that we think is acceptable? And I think a similar point is, are we relying on a data system or a machine learning system to try to fix or make up for a problem that has perhaps a simpler but politically harder solution?
Yes. Yes.
So something I've been looking at lately is in the wake of terrible school shootings, companies marketing social media monitoring products to both parents but especially to schools as a way of trying to monitor what kids are saying on social media and try to predict who might be at some risk of committing a violent act or self-harm or bullying or any number of things, when maybe if what we want to do is prevent school violence, like there are probably a few other more systemic changes mm-hmm. that need to happen. Similarly, in the criminal justice system, the I think the community that works on in the pretrial risk assessment space, the civil rights community that works on that, did a really good job framing the statement on pretrial risk assessments. So these are the assessments that are used to decide whether someone should be held or released while they're awaiting trial. And that statement didn't just say, okay, you're using these things, here are five things you need to do. It said, what we want is criminal justice reform. We want decarceration. Mm-hmm. If the tools you're using are not causing decarceration, then they're not getting us to the world that we want.
That's right.
And then, since we know you're using them, here are five things that they need to do.
Right.
But to the more practical stuff, so I think you mentioned the Algorithmic Accountability Act that has been introduced in both the House and the Senate, and also in New Jersey last year. So I think that's a good step. So this is the basic idea is requiring companies or whatever covered entities to do risk assessments of algorithms, looking at things like, where the data comes from and what the risks are of having discriminatory outcomes, things like that. And I think this is a positive step. Something that's missing is public transparency. Mm-hmm. So the current version would leave it up to the company whether they disclose, and I think we can all guess what decision they might make. It's not about necessarily asking people to disclose source code or proprietary information, but to disclose the outcome of a risk assessment, to disclose things like how they designed their tests, both for the accuracy of the model and for its outcomes for different populations, so that we can look at how the testing was done and say, well, maybe you tested for how this performed for women and for Black people, but not for Black women, mm-hmm. right? Intersectionality is a big thing that is not always captured in testing. There are also other bills that have been introduced in, the criminal justice space. There's the Justice and Forensic Algorithms Act, I believe it's called, and that would address the issue of forensic algorithms. So algorithms that are generally designed to try to analyze forensic, DNA samples that are difficult to analyze with traditional methods. for example, because there are multiple people's DNA in the same sample, or the sample is too small. And the bill would address the fact that, the companies that are building these things are not always disclosing them in discovery and criminal trials. So would basically force companies to waive trade secret protections when that evidence would normally be discoverable by a criminal defendant. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of I think, positive steps in terms of bills being introduced, both more general, like algorithm accountability, but also more targeted. And so I think we're coming into a space where a lot of like necessary conversations are happening, but it's still very hard because I think some people want there to be one solution and there isn't.
It can't be right.
It has to be a multi-pronged solution. There have to be accountability measures and there have to be criminal laws and civil rights laws that protect people and that prevent some of the uses that we're most worried about. There have to be self-regulatory measures as well. There has to be everything. There isn't one solution. But it's certainly a fun time to talk about all the options.
Yeah, I call it like an 80-20 rule, right? So I tell people 80% of the time, most of us actually are okay with our algorithms, right? If you think of your algorithm like a pet, we're okay with our algorithms. We like the recommendations for our services, products, etc. It's that 20% when it comes to the determination of really important stuff, our credit, our loans, our housing, where it's actually problematic. And so we also think that use cases are really important. I want to turn it over to questions and answers from the audience. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put out a couple of Brookings rules. Please ask a question and provide limited commentary so we can get as many questions as possible. And then we'll ask them the same of the panelists so we can answer a lot of your questions before we leave. So I'm going to start here, and then we'll work our way around in some way. Okay.
Hi, Bertram Lee, Policy Counsel with Public Knowledge. Good to see a lot of y'all again. I wanted to ask you all about specifically the Algorithmic Accountability Act and the optionality of a third-party audit. One of the things that is mandatory or was, I wouldn't say mandatory, but available within the context of civil rights law was the civil rights audit. And so how do you build that kind of functionality inside of an algorithmic system while also maintaining the trade secret law that kind of like upholds kind of like the underlying tech background of everybody
has? I'll get one person to answer that. Yep.
Yeah, just really quickly. And so I own and a founder of a tech company that is using AI in ways. And we shared a little bit about this. But so what I'm doing and what my company is doing is actually having a third-party independent validator. We are working with an actuarial firm to help to develop the processes that we evaluate our algorithms and then the outcomes. So we are embracing that notion of having that independent or third-party evaluator, and I think other organizations should do the same.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me go to the next question. Go to Deb.
Hi, I'm Deborah Lathan. And my question is, from last week, Washington Post reported that HireVue is using this algorithm for facial analytics, and it actually looks at your face and your motions and decides an employability score judging you against others. When I read it, I was actually appalled. My question is, should something like that be flat out banned? Or not?
Mm-hmm. For you?
Can you jump on that?
Salon, you want to go first and then Carl?
Yeah, so I mean, I may have a slightly contrarian view on this. I actually think that people's reactions to this are based maybe reasonably on a visceral sense that you shouldn't be judged on your appearance. And yet we seem pretty content to have interviews. And it's not to say that humans have the same exact problems as algorithms, but I often find it a little puzzling that we're so happy to continue to interview people, often because we don't really want to hire people we have never interacted with. But we have this immediate sense that when an algorithm is doing it, that there's something categorically different and like flat out wrong. I'm not defending its use. I think there's other reasons that we want to be suspicious of it. But I also think that when we reflect critically on some of these things, we should ask ourselves why we're content with some other process which actually continues to probably have the same kind of problems. Mm-hmm.
So I'll jump in there just quickly. So my problem with that particular algorithm, and just as a set aside, Goldman Sachs uses HireVue, so yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
or at least they did.
Right.
So my problem with that is getting back to understanding what's really happening in that black box and what decisions are being made. So that gets around basically explainability, which is something that the community is really working on, and it's a hard problem to inject explainability into this. And there's some interesting research that's going on out there, and I have a colleague at Rutgers who's doing some terrific work in that space. But my objection to it is you need to understand what's really happening there.
Right. And I, as a social scientist, Deb, I just have to add my two cents in. I think listening to both arguments, I think there's credibility to both sides, but I do think that we often forget the historical discrimination that comes in with hiring, right? And so part of the challenge with any new tools that enable people to discern those distinctions is no different as sociologists when I was studying the use of zip codes or other proxies that could determine whether or not somebody could be employed or not. Believe it or not, before there was facial recognition, there was name recognition. If my name was Shaniqua, Jaquan, something else, there were studies in sociology that said I was less likely to be interviewed or hired just simply by my name. That's why I was named Nicole at a certain point, I think, because my parents wanted to give me a name from England. But the bottom line is this historical discrimination has been happening for a really long time. We just have tools now that allow us to go into our homes and into our faces in ways that we couldn't do before. That was just my two cents. I'm sorry. Okay, let's, Russ, and then we're going to move to the other side for fairness. I'm not an algorithm, okay? I just have to share that.
Hi, my name's Shaniqua.
Right.
So Russ Hanser, and my question sort of picks up on this question. I'm a lawyer. Our civil rights regime is founded on laws that say you shall not discriminate on the basis of sex, gender, sexuality, disability status, etc. But what I, as a lawyer, know about AI, so I'm a lawyer, so that means probably not much, is that machine learning and deep learning systems are the best at finding correlations that are invisible to humans and for finding proxies for different variables. So I worry that in a civil rights regime that's based on these thou shalt nots, we can eliminate as many of these categories as we want, but the systems are going to find proxies for those characteristics. And the problem is, as the AI gets better and as the training sets get better, the problem is going to get worse, not better. So I guess my ultimate question is the advance of machine learning a fundamental threat to our civil rights regime? And if not, why not?
Wow. Read our stuff at Brookings, because you're so right. Okay, anybody up here, what do you think?
Oh, I think we're all afraid of that question. Right, I'll let Natasha jump in. I have a response, but,
Yeah, I mean, I think your concern is valid. I think I'll go back to, it's kind of a cop-out, but I'll go back to my question of when do we need to rely on data to fix a perceived problem, and when do we need a more systemic reform? So I think what makes hiring really difficult is there is a need to somehow decide among people and like rank and sort people. And none of the ways that people have tried to do it they've all been pretty inherently discriminatory. And so that's an area where it's really tough to figure out how we should think about machine learning's role and the role of bias and what kinds of bias we're willing to tolerate and not. But I think, in other areas, like the criminal justice system, there's a tendency, and like in the education algorithms that I've looked at, a tendency to lean on data systems to help categorize people when what is really needed is like more funding for better, more equitable schools, and more decarceration, and a fair overall criminal justice system. So
yeah.
This is a really important question, so I want to chime in. And actually, it's very close to the kind of research I've been doing for the past couple of years. So there's two things I'll say. So one is that there's no, like, legal definition of proxies, mm-hmm. and this is actually highly problematic Both because like we have some intuitions about what should be in scope, but then as like the set of features become more distant from those things that we have historically seen as being an obvious proxy, it becomes much more difficult to reason about whether or not that's a legitimate basis for making decisions, right? And I should note that the proposed change in the and the Fair Housing Act relies on this notion of proxies, even though it's not a settled term. But I do want to also point out that what we often worry about with proxies is that somehow actually what these systems are doing is engaging in disparate treatment without really recognizing that. But actually, if we think of disparate impact doctrine, I think we can kind of sidestep this problem by saying that like you bear a liability for not dealing with an avoidable disparate impact. And that doesn't matter. Like proxies are sort of irrelevant there. It's sort of saying if there's some other way of achieving the same business goal that minimizes the disparate impact, you're actually required to do it unless there's some like compelling cost or other justification. And so what's interesting about this is that algorithms can actually be helpful, potentially, in finding these alternative business practices. It can actually discover that like there's a way of achieving the same exact goal while actually minimizing the disparate impact. And if you don't do it, then you're liable. And so actually that creates some kind of interesting incentives in certain cases to try to deal with this problem, which to me is a much more direct way of getting at the problem than saying, like, what is a proxy and what is not a proxy?
That's right. Okay, so I'm going to actually have to not do some questions because we're running out of time. And so I'm going to try to do this because I see a lot of hands. Raise your hand if you had a question. Okay. All right. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to take one, and then our panelists will graciously stick around and answer more questions. And then we'll go from there. And I apologize because I'm sure there were questions in the webcast, but clearly, Lewis, we got to put more time to this stuff. And we will. So let's go to this lady with the leopard shirt on. She caught my eye in my progressive glasses. Ask your question.
Hi, my name is Dia Basu. I'm from the American University, and I want to thank you, Salon, for your comment about, you know, what do we need these technologies for, rather than saying these technologies are needed for everything that we do. My question to you is, a lot of the work that's being done on AI research is being done in the West. I come from India. The next billion users are going to come from the Global South. Already, India has the second largest internet population outside of China, Facebook's largest population, WhatsApp's largest user base, and the same will happen for countries like Indonesia and Egypt and Brazil. So my point is the Global South then going to become technology's dumping ground when the West realizes that, oops, we've made a big mistake with this?
You want to answer that? Follow up and close it out.
This is a great question. I guess there's two ways to think of this. There's actually a lot of cutting-edge research happening in these countries as well. So I don't think of this as being a field that's necessarily exclusively dominated by the West.
Right.
China is highly active in this area, and so is India. And if you actually go to the academic conferences for AI, the actual representation from these countries is pretty significant. What's interesting to me about it, though, is that the degree to which the kind of domestic regulations will affect the course of this research in these different countries. So there's a sense in which the kind of lack of privacy laws in the United States might have been essential to the development of some of these fields because we were able to repurpose data in ways that maybe other countries were not. There's certainly arguments about how the GDPR is going to make it much more difficult for Europe to compete. Similarly, we can think about whether or not the absence of similar laws or even the rule of law in some cases and these other jurisdictions might mean that there are certain things that the academic community, the research community, can pursue that is going to be actually difficult to do in the West. And so I would see it rather than it being like the dumping ground and more that the nature of the work actually happening in these places might be different given the regulatory environments.
Right. And I would add simply because in the last 3 weeks, I've been to Latin America and China and other places talking about this, that they're actually having a similar conversation. I think it goes back to an earlier comment that the conversation of bias is less binary in some of those cases and much more rich in terms of the potential of bias amongst the rich and the poor or different cultural distinctions or people who have more data available and less data. I think the overall piece, and we've actually seen this with the UN and the OECD, is that there's this fundamental human rights concern on the ability of these models to discriminate and create, I think, much more amplification of the stereotypes that we've tried to fight. But I would just say this going forward for all of you. First of all, thank you all for being here. Let's give a round of applause to the panel. And second of all, I want to say to all of you, again, I want to put a plug out for what we're doing at Brookings. We care about this issue. As a social scientist, I'm not a technologist, so I get to hang out with people who are. And many of the folks that are up here, as well as others across the country, are contributing to a paper series that we have to really unpack what this means. What's the fundamental definition of bias? How do you deal with it technically? What are the challenges with proving disparate impact? To what extent are there particular use cases that we have to be very careful about? And so you will see this trail of papers actually come in the next few weeks, if not days, around many of these topics, and I encourage you also to look at that. In addition to that, I think one of the things, and Natasha hit it on the nose, this is not something that may just be a public policy prescription, right? It may require some self-regulatory action along with public policy and some civil society engagement. So we are working here at Brookings on an algorithmic Energy Star rating or whatever that may be to really give people this opportunity to have these kinds of collaborative discussions that lead us to the right place in history so that we're not coming back and trying to figure out why we have overcriminalized, why we have denied people all of these opportunities where they have been foreclosed, I think, the new digital economy and what it offers. So take a look out for Brookings on that. That was a shameless plug, but you all are here and I can do that. And we thank you all again for coming. I'll ask the panelists just to hang out for a few minutes, but thank you again.